skin from fear or anger. Right, she said laconically. Second round. But Gideon was experiencing one powerful emotion. Being sick of everyone's shit. She unsheathed her sword. She slid her gauntlet over her hand and tightened the wrist straps with her teeth. And she looked over her shoulder at Harrowhark, who was apparently breaking out of a blue funk to experience her own dominant emotion of, oh, not again. Gideon silently willed her necromancer to put her knuckle bones where her mouth was, and for the first time in her life, for the first real time, do what Gideon needed her to do. And Harrowhark rose to the occasion like an evening star. The ninth house will represent the sixth house, she said, sounding cold and bored, as though this had been her plan all along. Gideon wanted to sing. Gideon wanted to dance her up and down the corridor. She broke out in a broad, unnervingly un-ninth smile, and Nibirius Turn, who had gone from greasy villainy to aggrieved caution, was having to force his smirk. Ianthe just looked a little amused. The plot congeals. Since when has the ninth been bosom with the sixth? When not? Then, Harrowhark said, in the exact sepulchral tones of Marshal Crux, death first to vultures and scavengers! Unable to bear it any longer, Jean-Marie hopped up on the table too. She held her shining fourth house rapier before her, the beautiful navy and silver fretwork of her dagger gripped in an altogether professional way at her hip. Although her puffy eyes and corrugated, unbrushed hair proved that she had not slept more than a few hours in the last few days, she looked intimidatingly ready. Gideon was coming to the conclusion that despite an overworked pituitary gland, there was really something in the Chatter name after all. Once you face her, you face the fourth house, she said ringingly. Fidelity and the Emperor! Nibirius Turn sheathed his sword and his neat gleaming knife, rolling his eyes so hard that they ought to have fallen backward into his sinuses. He sighed explosively and swung himself down from the table, wiping that stupid curl off his forehead with an airy head toss. I should have stayed home and gotten married, he said resentfully. As though anyone was even offering, snapped Ianthe. If you have all finished, said Silas Soctokizeron, with his deep, tyrannically servile politeness. Brother Asht and I are going to go and look for Protesilaus the Seventh. He is, after all, still missing. Which will somehow involve trying those keys you've taken in doors you've never been able to open, said Palamedes. What a coincidence! I have no interest in talking to you any more, said Silas. The warden of the sixth house is an unfinished inbred who passed an examination. Your companion is a mad dog, and I doubt her legal claim to the title of Cavalier Primary. I would not even bother to thrash her. Enjoy the patronage of the Shadow Cult while it lasts. I am sorry that it came to this. Brother Asht, we leave.
When they dispersed, it was with the manner of people reluctantly turning their backs on their enemies. The Eighth Master swept out with his cavalier like a legion retreating from a battlefield. The second, the unsteady cavalier supported by the captain's arm, looked even more so, with something of the tattered refugee thrown in. The three houses that were left looked at one another. Palamedes rounded on Harrowhark, his hands bloody and his shining eyes a little wild. He had torn off his spectacles, and there were greasy red thumbprints over the lenses.
There's only one more key, he said.
Harrow frowned.
One more to claim?
No. They've all been claimed. I've been through every challenge except the one I won't play ball with.
Harrow's frown deepened fractionally, but Gideon was putting the pieces together. So, too, apparently, was the necromantic teen, Isaac.
If there's only one of each key, he said slowly. What happens when you do a challenge someone else already completed?
Palamedes shrugged.
Nothing. I mean, you can do the challenge, but you get nothing at the end of it.
Jean-Marie said, So it's just a huge waste of time. And Gideon could not imagine how she'd have felt after the avulsion room if the plinth at the other end had been empty.
Sort of. The challenge itself is still instructional. It makes you think about things in a new way, right, Nona Jessimus?
The challenges so far, said Harrow carefully, have encouraged me to consider some striking possibilities.
Right, but it's like, imagine if someone showed you a new sword move or whatever, but then you never actually got to sit down and read up on how it worked. It might give you ideas, but you wouldn't really learn it. Do you follow?
Jean-Marie, Gideon and Camilla all stared at him.
What?
He said. The sixth learned sword fighting out of a book, said Jean-Marie, horrified.
No, put in Camilla. The warden just hasn't been to Swordsman's Spire since he was five and got lost.
Okay, okay,
Palamedes put his hands out. He was still holding the blood-stained spectacles.
That was clearly an inapposite comparison, but...
A challenge, taken purely as a necromantic exercise, said Harrow calmly, suggests many things but reveals none. Only the underlying theorem can lay bare the mystery.
And the theorems are behind the locked doors, Isaac said meditatively. Aren't they? You need the keys for the doors or you're screwed. Everyone's attention was on the two shitty teens. They both looked back, with no small scorn, all grief, uncombed hair and stud earrings.
We know about the doors, said Jean-Marie. We've seen the doors, and people go through the doors. Well, what else could we do? She added, somewhat defensively. If we hadn't been trailing everybody, it would have been that creep Ianthe Tridentarius, and she's stalking everyone, believe me.
And trailing differs from stalking, how?
Because the Force doesn't stalk?
Nothing was preventing you from getting your facility key, said Palamedes.
Isaac said emptily, Abigail said to wait for her. Gideon did not know how much the Sixth knew about the keys they'd amassed so far, or what they'd learned of the labs and the studies, how much they knew of the theorems. Palamedes was nodding, thoughtful.
Well, you've come to the right conclusion. Behind the doors, there are studies, and all eight, there's eight, obviously, one per house, contain notes on the relevant theorem. All eight theorems presumably add up to some kind of,
Mega-theorem,
supplied Isaac, who, after all, was like 13.
Mega-theorem, he agreed. The key to the secrets of Lictorhood.
Jean-Marie Chateau's brain had obviously ground forward, struggling past confusion and puberty hormones, to some slowly formed conclusion.
Wait. Go back, Sixth House, she demanded. What did you mean by one more key?
Palamedes drummed his fingers on the table.
Well, forgive me the explanation, Ninth. I know you've been keeping track of the keys.
Ha ha ha, thought Gideon. She hadn't.
But I couldn't work out how many keys Lady Septimus had. I knew she had at least one, but when Octokizeron convinced her to hand them over, he freighted convinced with such heavy scorn it ought to have fallen through the floor, he accidentally showed us her card. She had two. That means there's one left that I haven't accounted for, and we've got to account for it.
We need to find the seventh cav, added Camilla.
He nodded. Yes, and we also have to work out who the hell's in the incinerator. Ianthe Tridentarius was right, a sentence I don't like saying, in that there's more than one person in there.
Isaac said, I have a duty to find out who killed Magnus and Abigail, first and foremost.
You're right, Baron Tetteris, said Palamedes warmly, but trust me. I think answering those three questions will help us quite considerably in solving that mystery. Ninth, Protesilaus was still down in the facility as of last night.
Hera looked at him blankly. How do you know?
We saw him go in, said the fourth as one.
And Isaac added,
After we eavesdropped on you and the sixth.
Good for you.
But it makes sense, too. Lady Septimus said he didn't come back. And when we saw her key ring just now, it only had challenge keys, no hatch key. She must have given that to him so he could access the facility by himself, although why, I still don't know. I bet you the whole of my library's physical sciences section that he's still down there. It would be impossible for someone to bring him up without being seen.
Then we need to go down and look, said Jean-Marie, visibly impatient at the lack of action. Let's go!
Don't be so forth, said Palamedes. We should split up. We're fighting a battle on two fronts here. Frankly, I would not leave Lady Septimus unguarded sans cavalier with just the first house to guard her.
Harrowhark said, Her keys are gone. What's the attraction now?
Camilla said, Vulnerability.
Yes, it can't just be a game of keys, Nona Jessimus. Why did Magnus Quinn and Abigail Pent die when they had nothing on them but a facility key in their own good selves? Why has Protesilaus gone missing when the most he would have had was his facility key? Is he still down there? Who died before this challenge even began? And then there's the issue of the other houses. I do not know about you, Reverend Daughter, but until Cam's healed up, I plan on wetting myself lavishly.
Isaac gave a rather lame and high-pitched giggle. Camilla said gruffly,
Warden, it's just my right hand.
Hark at her. Just your right hand. My right hand, more like. God, Cam, I've never been so scared in all my life.
Harrowhark ignored this cavalier necromancer banter and cleared her throat pointedly.
Septimus, once guarding, her cavalier should be found. What do you suggest?
The fourth house stays with the Lady Dulcinea, said Palamedes, slipping his glasses back over his long nose. Gideon the ninth stays with them as backup. You, I, and Camilla go down to the facility and see if we can locate Protesilaus.
There was more than one bewildered stare aimed his way. His own cavalier looked at him as though he had taken leave of his senses, and Hera yanked her hood off her head painfully as though to relieve her feelings.
Sextus, she said, as though to a very stupid child. Your necromancer is wounded. I could kill the both of you and take your keys, or just take your keys, which would be worse. Why would you willingly put yourself in that position?
Because I am placing my trust in you, said Palamedes.
Yes, even though you're a black anchorite and loyal only to the numinous forces of the locked tomb, if you'd wanted my keys through chicanery, you would have challenged me for them a long time ago.
I don't trust Silas Octokizeron, and I don't trust Ianthe Tridentarius. But I trust the Reverend Daughter Harrowhark Nona Jessimus.
Beneath the paint, Gideon could see that Harrow had changed colours a number of times through this little speech. She went from being a rather ashen skeleton to a skeleton who was improbably green around the gills. To an outsider, it would have just been a blank ninth house mask twinging from dark mystery to cryptic mystery, giving nothing away. But to Gideon, it was like watching fireworks go off.
Her necromancer said gruffly, Fine, but we'll watch over the seventh house. I'm not going down the ladder with your invalid cavalier.
Palamedes said, Fine, perhaps that's better use of our talents anyway. Fourth, are you all right to go with Gideon the ninth? I realize I am presupposing that our motives all align, but all I can assure you is that they really do. Search the facility, and if you find him, or come up short, come back to us, and we'll move from there. Get in and get out.
The bleary necromantic team looked to his bleary cavalier. Jean-Marie said immediately, We'll go with the ninth. She's all right. The stories about the ninth house seem probably bullshit anyway.
She's all right? Gideon's heart billowed, despite the fact that she had her own suspicions as to why her necromancer didn't want her sitting with Dulcinea Septimus, and they were all extremely petty. The sixth house adept adjusted his glasses again and said,
"Sorry, ninth cavalier. I should ask you your thoughts on all of this."
She cracked the joints in the back of her neck as she considered the question, stretching out the ligaments, popping her knuckles.
He urged again, "Thoughts?"
Gideon said, "Did you know that if you put the first three letters of your last name with the first three letters of your first name, you get sex pal?" The dreadful teens both stared with eyes so wide you could have marched skeletons straight through them.
"You... do you talk?" said Isaac.
"You'll wish she didn't," said Camilla. Her wound had opened again. Palamedes was searching his pockets and the sleeves of his robe for more handkerchiefs to staunch it. As the fourth conducted a quick conversation in what they thought were whispers, Hera came to Gideon and unwillingly passed over the great iron ring that their keys jingled on, bodies almost pressing, so that she could keep them out of sight of Palamedes.
"Come back with these, or having choked on them," she whispered, "and don't get complacent around the fourth. Never work with children, Griddle. Their prefrontal cortexes aren't developed. Now!"
Gideon put her arms around Herohark. She lifted her up off the ground just an inch and squeezed her in an enormous hug before either she or Hero knew what she was about. Her necromancer felt absurdly light in her grip, like a bag of bird's bones. She had always thought, when she bothered to think, that Hera would feel cold, as everything in the ninth felt cold. No, Hera Nona Jesimus was feverishly hot. Well, you couldn't think that amount of ghastly thoughts without generating energy.
Hang on, what the hell was she doing?
"Thanks for backing me up, my midnight haggit," said Gideon, placing her back down. Hera had not struggled, but gone limp, like a prey animal feigning death. She had the same glassy thousand-yard stare and stilled breathing. Gideon belatedly wished to be exploded, but reminded herself to act cool.
"I appreciate it, my crepuscular queen. It was good. You were good."
Hera, at a total loss for words, eventually managed the rather pathetic,
"Don't make this weird, Nav,"
and stalked off after Palamedes. Jean-Marie sidled up alongside Gideon, rather shyly. Isaac was parasitically drifting with her. He was in the process of braiding her curly hair safely up with a tatty blue ribbon. She said, "Have you two been paired a very long time?"
"Don't just ask them that," her necromancer hissed. "It's a weird thing to ask." "Shut up! It was just a question."
Gideon contemplated the growing braid and the sight of Palamedes squeezing the noxious contents of a blue dropper into Camilla's wound, and Camilla kneeing him with beautiful abruptness in the thigh. Herohark lurked next to them, pointedly not looking at Gideon, head hidden deep inside her second-best hood. She still didn't understand what she was meant to do or think or say, what duty really meant between a cavalier and a necromancer, between a necromancer and a cavalier.
"It feels like forever," she said honestly.
Gideon slipped her dark-tinted glasses out of her pocket and slid them on, and she felt better for it.
"Come on, let's go."
Chapter 25.
Despite the fact that they now knew Gideon had a working pair of vocal reeds and the will to use them, the trip down to the facility was spent in silence. Any travel into the depths of the first house put both of the teens on high alert. They were so paranoid they would have been welcomed into the dark bosom of the suspicious ninth. Both startled at every shadow and watched the passing by of creaking skeletons with no little hate and despair. They did not like the open terrace, where the waves howled far below, nor the cool marble hallway, nor the marble stairwell that led down to the nondescript room with the hatch to the facility. They only spoke when Gideon slipped her facility key into the hatch and turned it with a sharp click. It was Jean-Marie, and she was troubled.
"We still don't have a key," she said. "Maybe we shouldn't be here."
"Abigail died, and she had permission," said her counterpart somberly. "Who cares?"
"I'm just saying."
"I've been down without permission," said Gideon, as she used one booted foot to ease the hatch open. Cold air wheezed out like a pent-up ghost. "The Sixth let me in once without a key, and I'm still breathing."
Jean-Marie seemed uncomforted and unconvinced, so she added,
"Hey, look at it this way. You were down here just the other night, so if that's the sticking point, you're already totally boned."
"You don't talk like..."
"How I thought you might talk," said Isaac.
All three travelled down the cold, dark staple ladder to the fluorescent lights and dead stillness of the landing. Gideon went first. The other two lagged behind a little, captivated by the increasingly old and bloody gobbets that still decorated the grill at the bottom. She had to herd them forward, down the tunnel that led to the radial room, to the ancient whiteboard and the signs above the warren of corridors. She turned. Jean-Marie and Isaac had not come with her. Jean-Marie had stopped in the doorway, pressing herself flat against it, looking around at the strange anachronistic tunnels of steel and plate metal and LED lighting.
"I thought I heard a noise," she said, eyes darting back and forth.
"Coming from where?" She didn't answer. Isaac, who had pressed himself into the shadows where the side of the doorway met the wall, said,
"Ninth, why were bone fragments found in Magnus's body and in Abigail's?"
"Don't know. It's a good question."
"At first I thought it meant the skeletons," he said, in a sunken whisper,
which made sense from the nonsense of why he and his cavalier had jumped at the creaking approach of each bone servant in the place.
"There's something unnatural about the constructs upstairs, like they're listening to you."
Gideon looked back at both of them. They had pressed themselves into either side of the corridor, not daring to come into the open space, pupils very dilated as though with adrenaline. They both looked at her, the young cavalier with her brown eyes muddy in the darkness, the young necromancer with his deep hazel eyes and spider-leggy mascara. Pressurized air from some cooling fan wheezed through a vent, making the ceiling creak.
"Come on, don't just lurk there," said Gideon impatiently. "Let's find this guy. It shouldn't be too hard. He's massive."
Neither wanted to be coaxed out. Their puff had seemed to leave them. They clustered close together, grave-faced and tense. Isaac raised a hand and faint, ghost-like flames appeared at his fingertips, bluish-greenish, giving off a sickly little light that did not do much to illuminate what was going on around them. He insisted on warding every single radiating doorway, daubing blood and his cavalier spit around the mouth of each corridor. He was nervous and crabby, and it was slow work applying team gunge to every single exit.
"His enclosures are good," Jean-Marie kept saying defensively.
"I thought the Fourth were meant to be all about head-first dives and getting all crazy," said Gideon, who stared hard into every shadow.
"It's stupid to get killed if it doesn't help," said Isaac,
tracing his thumb in curious shapes along the doorjamb.
"The Fourth isn't cannon fodder. If we're first on the ground, we need to stay alive. Wards were the first thing I learned. When we get shipped out next year, we'll get them scarified onto our backs."
Next year.
Gideon was taut with impatience, but still spent a couple of seconds grappling with the notion that the gawky teens in front of her would be facing the Empire's foes at age 15 and whatever. For all that she'd longed to be on the front lines from the age of 8 up, it suddenly didn't seem like such a great idea.
"We wanted to go this year," said the cavalier dolorously,
but Isaac got mumps a week before deployment. Remembrance of Isaac's mumps threw them both into gloom, but at least that diluted their terror. In the end, Gideon found herself leading them down the hallway marked Sanitizer, the place where she had first found Harrow. Their three pairs of feet kicked up huge scuffs of white powder, glowing mixed colours under Isaac's necrolight, settling down in silent sprays in the panel grouting, grinding to nothing beneath their footsteps. The doors moaned open to the panelled maze of stainless steel cubicles, and the vents moaned too in sympathy, creaking so much that the teens both gritted their molars. Hera's old blood was still here, but Protesilaus wasn't. They all split up to walk the maze of metal tables, checking beneath them to see if he had lain down for a swift nap or something equally probable. They prowled rows of metal cubicles, all empty. They called out, "Hello!" and "Protesilaus!" their voices reverberating thinly off the walls. As the echoes faded, they heard the scuttling noises of air being blown through the vent's metal teeth. "There's something here," Isaac said. They all listened. Gideon could hear nothing but the sounds of old machinery running in the same exhausted way it had run for thousands of years, kept alive by perfect mechanism and necromantic time. They were no different from the background noises of the Ninth House. She said, "I can't hear it."
"It's not just hearing," said Isaac, brow furrowing. "It's more what I'm feeling. There's movement here,"
Jean-Marie said. "Another house?"
"No."
"Wards?"
"Nothing."
She stalked the facility with her rapier drawn and her dagger clutched in her hand. Gideon, stranger to teamwork, worried that if she startled her by accident, she'd end up with the Fourth's offhand in her gut. Isaac said,
"Bodies were brought into here a long time ago. A lot of bone matter. The first feels like a graveyard all over, but this is worse. I'm not faking."
"I believe you," said Gideon. "Some of the stuff I've seen down here would ruin your eyelids. I don't know what the hell they were researching, but I don't like it. Only bright side is that it's all pretty self-contained."
"I'm not super certain," said the adept. Sweat was beading on his brow.
Jean-Marie said, "He's not in here. Let's go somewhere else." They left the bright antiseptic room of Sanitizer. The lights went off with rhythmic boom, boom, booms as Gideon pressed down on the touchpad that still held little black whirls of Hera's blood, and they spilled out into the corridor. Sweat was openly dripping down the sides of Isaac's temples now. His cavalier threw her arm over his shoulder, and he buried his hot, wet face in her shoulder. Gideon again found this difficult to look at.
"Let's bounce," said Jean-Marie.
As they turned the corner to where the sanitizer corridor met the main artery, the rhythmic boom, boom, boom of light shutting down caught up with them. The lights in the grill beneath them winked out of existence, and so did the dully glowing panels above, and so did the bright lights ringing the big square room ahead. They were left in total darkness, every nerve in Gideon's body singing with fear. She ripped her glasses off to try to cope. The necromancer was close to hyperventilating. His cavalier kept saying with eerie calm,
"Your wards aren't tripped. It's just the lights. Don't freak out."
"The wards
aren't tripped. You're good with wards. There's nobody down here."
One of the motion sensor lights struggled back on behind them, a short way down the passage. A ceiling panel threw the metal siding into sharp white relief. It was daubed with words that had not been there a few seconds before, written in blood so fresh and red that there were little drips.
"Death to the Fourth House!"
The light flickered off. After no sleep, after days of threat and grief and panic that would have floored a man twice his age, Isaac lost it completely. With a strangled cry, he flared in a halo of blue and green. Jean-Marie yelled, "Isaac, behind me!"
But he was sizzling with light, too bright to see by, a sun and not a person. Gideon heard him flee into the room ahead of them, blinded by the running Aurora. When her eyes cleared, Gideon was confronted with the biggest skeletal construct she had ever seen. The room was full of it, bluely aflame with Isaac's light, a massed hallucination of bones. It was bigger by far than the one in response, bigger than anything recorded in a ninth history textbook. It had assembled itself into the room by no visible means, since it never could have fit through one of the doors. It was just simply, suddenly, there, like a nightmare, a squatting, vertiginous hulk, a nonsense of bones feathering into long, spidery legs, leaning back on them fearfully and daintily, trailing jellyfish stingers made up of millions and millions of teeth, all set into each other like a jigsaw. It shivered its stingers, then stiffened all of them at once with a sound like a cracking whip. There was so much of it! It was cringing away from Isaac Tetteras, who had planted his feet wide in line with his hips and was screaming soundlessly in fear and anger. He had thrown his arms out wide as though in embrace, and there was a sodium explosion in the air between him and the room-cramping construct. It left a suction, like he was trying to drag something out of the unwilling creature. Bright blue points of contact appeared on it, and the mass of bone and energy began to lose form, drifting instead toward Isaac, tiny bones plinking down to the grill like rain. Gideon woke from her confusion, drew her sword, and ran. With a gauntleted hand, she picked up the nearest stinger and yanked it, then smashed the back of her heavy glove into another, finding a naked shank of leg bone and punching it as hard as she could. One of the tendrils of teeth wrapped around her ankle, but she found purchase and stamped it into a corona of molars. Gideon looked behind her to see Jean-Marie whipped off her feet by another tendril, lashing out wildly with her feet and her blades. Everywhere she looked was filled with construct. Everywhere Isaac's light touched there was a veritable cancer of bone and tooth. Gideon bellowed, voice deadened by 1,000,000,000 frigging bones. Run! Don't fight it! Run! But the enormous thing slapped another couple dozen tendrils down on the grill, sinuous and flexed into long, sharp wires. Isaac's blue-green fire fell upon a giant trunk of bone, a skull terrifically mangled into the thing's only coherent core, a simulacrum of a face with closed eyes and closed lips, as though locked perpetually in prayer. This vast mask loomed down from the ceiling and strained beneath Isaac's pull. One of the tendrils gave in and was sucked into the vortex that the fourth house was so valiantly creating. The spirit pinned to it was dissolving, the limb pattering into individual bits, one among hundreds. Isaac did not stop, and he did not run. It was one of the bravest and stupidest things Gideon had ever fucking seen. The construct teetered, getting its footing, cocking its great head as though in contemplation. The long, straight spars of teeth hovered above the necromancer, bobbing and warping occasionally, as though about to be sucked into his fiery gyre. Then at least 50 of them speared him through. Blue fire and blood sprayed the room. Gideon sheathed her sword, set her shoulders, put one arm up above her eyes, and charged through the field like a rocket. It was like running through a landslide. 1,000 fragments of bone ripped her robes to shreds and tore at every inch of exposed skin. She didn't pay them any mind, but crashed into Jean-Marie Chatur like the vengeance of the Emperor. Jean-Marie had no intention of stopping. She was tearing into her unbeatable foe as though running away had never been in question. She barely seemed to notice that Gideon had grabbed her, her limbs thrashing, her throat one long howl that Gideon only translated later. Fidelity! 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 How she scrambled through that hallway, the other girl clutched to her bosom, long tendrils of bones snaking after them from the central room, she did not know. The fact that she shinnied up the ladder with Jean-Marie attached, kicking and screaming, was even more unlikely. She tossed the cavalier down. She would have been surprised if the girl had even felt it, slammed the hatch lid, and turned the key so frantically that it made gouges in the metal. Jean-Marie rolled over on the cold black tiles, and she threw up. She pulled herself up on her bone-whipped, cut-up, bashed-in arms and legs, wobbling, and she began to shake. She sank back to her knees and screamed like a whistle. Gideon caught her up again. The grief-stricken teenager thrashed and bit and started off on a jog away from the hatch. Jean-Marie kept kicking in her arms.
"Put me down," she wept. "Let me go back. He needs me. He could still be alive."
"He's seriously not," said Gideon. Jean-Marie the Fourth screamed again.
"I want to die," she said afterward.
"Tough luck."
She did, at least, stop kicking. The myriad cuts over Gideon's hands and face were starting to really sting, but she paid them no mind. It was still a deep black night outside, and the wind was howling around the side of Canaan House. She carried Jean-Marie inside and down the big rotting staircase, and then she absolutely blanked on what to do next. The Fourth House Cavalier couldn't even stand. She was reduced to the small, disbelieving sobs of someone whose heart had broken forever. It was the second time Gideon had listened to Jean-Marie really cry, and the second time was a lot worse than the first. She had to get her to safety. Gideon wanted her longsword, and she wanted her... There were the ninth quarters, but bone wards could be broken, even Harrow's. She could march straight to where the others were guarding Dulcinea, but that was a long way to go with her catatonic cargo, and if she met an avaricious Nibirius or an over-obedient column, she'd still prefer them to whatever was down there, in the facility, in the dark. Gideon's hand was still gripping the keyring with the facility key she had just now so frantically used, and the red key on it. And lightning struck. Jean-Marie did not ask where they were going. Gideon ran down the soggy Canaan House staircase and across silent nighttime corridors and down the sloping little passage that led to the foyer for the training rooms. She pushed aside the tapestry and sprinted down the hall to the great black door that Hero had called X-203. The door and the lock were so black in the night, and she was so slippery with fear, that for an excruciating minute she couldn't seem to find the keyhole. And then she found it, and slid the red key home, and opened the door to the long-abandoned study. The rail of spotlights all lit up, illuminating the clean laminate countertops of the laboratory and the still-shining wooden stairs to the living room. She slammed the door shut behind them and locked it so quickly that it ought to have broken the sound barrier. Gideon half-heaved, half-carried Jean-Marie up the staircase and put her down on the squashy armchair, which wheezed with the sudden use. The sorrowful teen curled into a fetal position, bleeding and hiccuping. Gideon barreled away and started taking stock of the room, wondering if she could haul the big wooden bookcases down as barricades.
"Where are we?"
the Fourth eventually said drearily. "One of the key rooms. We're safe here. I'm the only one with a key."
"What if it breaks down the door?"
Gideon said bracingly. "Are you kidding? That thing's 3-inch thick iron." This neither comforted nor satisfied Jean-Marie, who had possibly seen a makeshift blockade in the other girl's eyes, but her crying diminished. Every 5 seconds another sob would rack her, but she had swapped weeping for hysterical sucked-in breaths, until she said,
"It's not fair,"
and started up again with the great lung-filling fits of tears. Gideon had moved before the aged gun, frightened into wondering whether or not it worked. Who knew? The swords still all held edges.
"No, it's not. You don't understand."
The cavalier was fighting for control, fierce eyes wet with hate and despair. She was shivering so hard that she was vibrating.
"Isaac's cautious, not reckless. He's not... He didn't... He was always so careful. He shouldn't have. I hated him when we were little. He wasn't at all what I wanted."
She gave in to crying again. When she could, she said,
It's not fair! Why did he get stupid now? There was absolutely nothing Gideon could say to this. She needed more firepower than bookcases and antiques. What she badly needed was Hero Nonagesimus, for whom a gigantic construction of bones would be more fun opportunity than hellish monstrosity. And she needed her longsword. But she couldn't leave Jean-Marie, and right now Jean-Marie was a liability. She mopped her hands over her bleeding face, demolishing her face paint and trying to get her thoughts straight and settled on.
Look, we'll stay in here until you're fighting fit. Don't try to tell me you're fit. You're exhausted, you're in shock, and you look like hot puke. Take half an hour, lie down, and I'll get you some water.
It took an enormous effort to get Jean-Marie onto one of the dusty, mattress-squeaking beds, and much more effort to get her to take even tiny sips of the water that came out of the tap at the laboratory. The pipes rattled in shock that they were being used in a little tin mug that had probably not had anybody's lips near it since the Ninth House was young. The recalcitrant teen drank a little, rested her head on the spongy old pillow, and her shoulders shook for a long time. Gideon settled down in the overstuffed armchair and kept her rapier out over her knees.
What was that thing?
Gideon startled. She had been lulled into a fug of reverie, and Jean-Marie's voice was thick with weeping and the pillow.
Dunno, she said. All I know is that I'm going to kick its ass for it.
Another moment's silence. Then, this is the first time Isaac and me really left the house. I wanted him to sign us up to go out to the front ages ago, but Abigail said no, and he wouldn't. I mean, he's got 3 younger brothers and 4 younger sisters to look after. He had, I mean.
It sounded as though she was going to burst into tears again. Gideon said,
That's a significant amount.
You need spares when you're in the 4th house, said Jean-Marie, sniffling. I've got 5 sisters. Do you have a big family?
The 9th doesn't do big families. I think I'm an orphan.
Well, that's pretty 4th house too, said the Cav. My mum jumped on a grenade during the Pioneer expedition, even though she wasn't supposed to be out on post-colony planets beyond the Rim. Isaac's dad went out on a state visit to hold a planet and got blown up by insurgents.
There was no more after that. Not even tears.
After a few minutes, Gideon was not surprised to see that the poor, bloodied girl had cried herself unconscious.
She did not wake her. There would be time enough to wake her, and even a short rest would probably do her good. It sucked to be a teen, and it sucked more to be a teen whose best friend had just died in a horrible way, even if you were used to mothers jumping on grenades and fathers getting exploded. At least in the 9th house, the way you usually went was pneumonia, exacerbated by senility. Gideon rested her head on the fat back of the armchair. She would not have said it was at all possible, but watching the rise and fall of Jean-Marie's breath, a safe up-and-down rhythm, the drying tear stains on the sleeping teen's cheeks, she promptly fell asleep.
It couldn't have been long. 15 minutes at the very most. She startled awake with the sheer unconscious panic of someone realizing they couldn't afford to slip into deep REM, a haptic jerk flicking her awake. Her sword rattled off her knees and jangled to the floor. The only sound that could have woken her was a persistent drip she'd thought was coming from the tap. Gideon did not understand what she was looking at when she awoke. And when she cleared her eyes and looked properly, she still didn't understand. Jean-Marie was still lying prone in the old bed, arms and legs now flung wide, as if she had kicked off the blankets and sheets in a bad dream. This would have been fine, except for the huge shafts of bones spearing each shoulder to the mattress, 2 more through the thighs, 1 straight through the very center of her ribs.
These spears of bone met Jean-Marie's body with halos of red splotching through her clothes, seeping into the bedspread.
No, said Gideon meditatively.
No, 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 no!
Jean-Marie's eyes were very slightly open. There was blood spattered in her curls, and there was blood spattered over the headboard. Gideon's gaze followed the splatter upward. Written on the wall in silky wet red was, Sweet Dreams.
Act 4 Chapter 26 Side by side, the fourth teens were laid to an uneasy sleep in the morgue, right next to the adults who had failed so terminally to look after them. Somebody had...
How?
It was a mystery. Taken the cooling body from Gideon's arms. Who had plucked those spears from those terrible holes and carried Jean-Marie back? And a lot of people had spoken a lot of words to her, none of which had pierced her short-term memory. Teacher was there, in her mind's eye, praying over the broken sieve of Isaac Tetterus, and Herohark was in there somewhere too, and Palamedes, tweezering a big fragment of something out of the cooling corpse of Jean-Marie the Fourth. These images were as jumbled up and lacking in context as a dream. She remembered one thing, Herohark saying, "You dullard! You imbecile! You fool!" All the old contempt of the Ninth House nursery back, and fresh as though she were there again. Hero the architect sweeping down the halls of Dreaber, Hero the nemesis flanked by Crux. It wasn't clear what in particular Hero was haranguing her for, but whatever the reason, she deserved it. Gideon had tuned out all the rest of the necromancer's tirade, her head in her hands. And then Herohark had balled up her fists, breathed hard once through her nose, and gone away. The only thing that had made sense was that she had ended up in the whitewashed room where they were keeping Dulcinea, sitting alone in an armchair, and there she had gritted tears out of her eyes for an hour. Someone had washed out all her cuts with reeking vermilion tarry stuff, and it smelled bad and hurt like hell whenever an errant drip of salt water touched the wounds. This made her feel sorry for herself, and feeling sorry for herself made her eyes even wetter. Dulcinea Septimus was a good person to do this in front of. She did not say, "You'll be fine," as Dulcinea lacked the lung capacity to spend on platitudes. She just sat propped up on about 15 pillows and kept her thin, hot hand on Gideon's palm. She waited until Gideon had stopped her hard blinking, and then she said, "There was nothing you could have done."
"Bullshit, there wasn't anything I could have done," said Gideon. "I've thought of everything I should have done. There's about 50 things I could have done and didn't."
Dulcinea gave her a crooked smile. She looked terrible. It was a few hours before morning, and the early light was grey on her biscuit-coloured curls and blanched skin. The fine green veins at her throat and wrist seemed terribly prominent, like most of her epidermis had sloughed off already. When she breathed, it sounded like custard sloshing around an air conditioner. There was high colour in her cheeks, but it had the hectic brilliance of hot slag.
"Oh, could've, should've," she said. "You can could have and should have yourself back into last week, back into the womb. I could have kept Pro by my side, or I should have gone with him. I can go back and make things happen perfectly if I just think about what I should have or could have done. But I didn't. You didn't. That's the way it is."
"I can't bear it," said Gideon honestly. "It's just such crap."
"Life is a tragedy," said Dulcinea, "left behind by those who pass away, not able to change anything at all. It's the total lack of control. Once somebody dies, their spirit's free forever, even if we snatch it or try to stop it or use the energy it creates. Oh, I know, sometimes they come back, or we can call them, in the manner of the fifth. But even that exception to the rule shows their mastery of us.
They only come when we beg. Once someone dies, we can't grasp at them anymore, thank God. Except for one person, and he's very far from here, I think. Gideon, don't be sorry for the dead. I think death must be an absolute triumph.
Gideon could not get behind this. Jean-Marie had died like a dog while Gideon napped, and Isaac had been made into a big teenage colander. She wanted to be sorry for them forever. But before she could say anything to this effect, a great cough that filled up about 2½ handkerchiefs tore at Dulcinea. The contents of these handkerchiefs made Gideon envy the dead, let alone Dulcinea. "We'll find your cav," she said, trying to sound steady and failing so completely she set a record.
"I just want to know what happened," said Dulcinea drearily. "That's always the worst of it, not knowing what happened."
Gideon didn't know whether she could get behind this either. She would have been devoutly grateful to live not knowing exactly the things that had happened, in vivid red and purple wobbling intensity. Then again, her mind kept flaying itself over Magnus and Abigail, down there in the dark alone, over the when and the how, over whether Magnus had watched his wife be murdered like Jean-Marie had watched Isaac. She thought, it is stupid for a cavalier to watch their necromancer die. Gideon felt hot and empty and eager to fight. She said, without real hope, "If you want your keys back from Silas Octokizeron, I'll deck him for you." The coughing turned into a bubbling laugh.
"Don't," said Dulcinea. "I gave them up freely by my own will. What would I want with them now?"
Gideon asked baldly, "Why were you trying to do this whole thing in the first place?"
"Do you mean, even though I'm dying?"
Dulcinea gave a friable smile, but one with a dimple in it.
"That's not a complete barrier. The seventh house thinks my condition is an asset. They even wanted me to get married and keep the genes going. Me! My genes couldn't be worse, in case they produced poetry down the line."
"I don't understand." The woman in front of her shifted, raising her hand to brush a few fawn-coloured strands away from her forehead. She didn't answer for a while. Then she said,
"When you don't have it too badly, when you can live to maybe 50 years, when your body's dying from the inside out, when your blood cells are eating you alive the whole time, it makes for such a necromancer, Gideon the Ninth, a walking thanagy generator. If they could figure out some way to stop you when you're mostly cancer and just a little bit woman, they would. But they can't. They say my house loves beauty. They did, and they do. And there's a kind of beauty in dying beautifully, in wasting away, half alive, half dead, within the very queenhood of your power." The wind whistled, thin and lonely against the window.
Dulcinea struggled to raise herself up on her elbows before Gideon could stop her, and she demanded,
"Do I look like I'm at the queenhood of my power?"
This would have made anyone sweat.
If you lie, I'll mummify you."
"You look like a bucket of ass." Dulcinea eased herself back down, giggling fretfully.
"Gideon," she said, "I told your necromancer I didn't want to die, and it's true. But I've been dying for what feels like 10,000 years. I more didn't want to die alone. I didn't want them to put me out of sight. It's a horrible thing to fall out of sight. The seventh would have me sealed in a beautiful tomb and not talked about me again. I wouldn't give them the satisfaction, so I came here when the Emperor asked me, because I wanted to, even though I knew I came here to die." Gideon said, "But I don't want you to die," and realized a second afterward that she had said it aloud.
The first finger and thumb of the hand ringed around hers. The dark blue eyes were luminous, too luminous. Their luster was wet and hot and bright, and Gideon pressed those fingers between her hands very carefully. It felt as though even a little bit of pressure would crush Dulcinea to dust between her palms, like the very oldest bones kept in the ninth house Os. Her heart felt sore and tender. Her brain felt sore and dry.
"I don't plan on it, you know," said Dulcinea,
though her voice was thinning out now, like water poured into milk. She closed her eyes with a gravelly sigh.
"I'll probably live forever, worse luck. Whatever happened to one flesh, one end?"
"I've seen those words before," said Gideon, thoughtless of where she had seen them. "What do they mean?" The blue eyes cracked open.
"They're not familiar."
"Should they be?"
"Well," said Dulcinea calmly, "you would have said them to your reverend daughter the day you pledged yourself in the service of her cavalier, and she would have said them to you. But you never did that, did you? You weren't trained in the traditions of the House of the Locked Tomb, and you're nothing like a Ninth House nun. And you fight like... I don't know. I'm not even certain you were raised in the Ninth House."
Gideon let her head rest against the bedframe momentarily. When she had thought about this moment, she had expected to feel panic. There was no more panic left in the box. She just felt tired. "Rumbled," she said. "I'm sick of pretending, so yeah. Right on nearly all those counts. You know I'm the fakest-ass cavalier who ever faked. The actual cav had chronic hypothyroid and was a serial limp dick. I've been faking my way through his duties for less than 2 months. I'm a pretend cavalier. I could not be worse at it." The smile she got in return had no dimples. It was strangely tender, as Dulcinea was always strangely tender with her, as though they had always shared some delicious secret.
"You're wrong there," she said. "If you want to know what I think... I think that you're a cavalier worthy of a lictor. I want to see that, what you'd become. I wonder if the reverend daughter even knows what she has in you."
They looked at each other, and Gideon knew that she was holding that chemical blue gaze too long. Dulcinea's hand was hot on hers. Now the old panic of confession seemed to rise up. Her adrenaline was getting a second wind from deep down in her gut, and in that convenient moment the door opened. Palamedes Sextus walked in with his big black bag of weird shit, adjusted his glasses, and stared 2 seconds too long at their hands' proximity. There was something dreadfully tactful and remote and un-Palamedes-y as he said,
"I came to check in on the both of you. Bad time." "Only in that I am officially out," said Gideon, snatching her hand away. Everyone was mad at her, which was great, albeit they could not possibly be as mad as she was. She stood and rolled her neck until all the joints popped and crackled anxiously, was relieved to find her rapier still on her hip, and squared up to Palamedes, feeling terrifically dusty and guilty.
"I'm going back to my quarters." "No, I'm fine, quit it. Thanks for the ointment. It smells bewitchingly like piss."
"For God's sake, Ninth," said Palamedes impatiently. "Sit back down, you need to rest. Cast your mind back to previous rests I have enjoyed." "Yeah, nah. It's not even ointment, it's drawing salve. Be reminded that Cam pulled 20 bone splinters out of you and said there were still a dozen left.
Nona Jesimus can get them out, or maybe not," added Gideon, a bit wildly. "Might as well leave them in until I'm through getting people bumped off, am I right?"
"Ninth."
She indulged herself in storming out past the warden of the sixth and in careering down the hallway like a bomb. It was about the least
dignified way to leave a perfectly normal conversation, but it was also really satisfying, and it got her out of there in record time. Gideon staggered down the hallway, picking orange goo out of her fingernails, and it was in this scratchy frame of mind that she nearly knocked down Silas Octokizeron in his floaty, bactericidal Eighth House whites. Column the Eighth flanked him automatically, looking more like jaundice than ever in the same colour.
"They are dead, then,"
his uncle said, by way of hello. The only thing that saved Gideon from howling like an animal was the relief that, finally, she would get the chance to shove one of Octokizeron's feet so deep into his ass he'd be gargling with his calcaneus. "They had names, you lily-livered, tooth-coloured asshole," she said, "and if you want to make a thing about it, I warn you that I'm in the kind of mood that can only be alleviated by walloping you." Colm blinked. His necromancer did not.
"I had heard that you were speaking now," he said. "It seems a pity. Save your gaucherie for someone else, Gideon Nerve. I've no interest in the frightened rantings of a Ninth House thrall."
"What did you call me?"
"Thrall," said Silas. "Serf. Servant."
"I don't want a bunch of synonyms, you smarmy cloud-looking motherfucker," said Gideon. "You said Gideon Nerve."
"Villain,"
continued the necromancer of the House of the Eighth, warming to his thesaurus. Colm was staring at Gideon, almost cross-eyed with disbelief.
"Foundling, I am not insulting you. I am naming you for what you are, the replacement for Ortus Nigernad, himself a poor representative of a fetid house of betrayers and mystics."
Gideon's brain skidded to a halt. It went back again to Dreaba, sitting with a fat lip and wicked friction burns on her wrists. The cries of the dwindling faithful, green lights in the powdery dark, the greasy smell of incense. A woman weeping, someone stealing her getaway shuttle. 1,000,000 years ago. 2 someones. One sad, one sadder. Immigrants to the Ninth House themselves.
"She still has family back on the Eighth."
"You've been listening to Sister Glorica," she said slowly.
"I talked to Glorica on her return to the Mother House," said Silas, "and now I'd like to talk to you."
"Me? The thrall? The servant? The other 5 words you said?"
"Yes," said the boy. "Because you grew up servant to a murderer in a tribe of murderers, you are, more than anything, a victim of the Ninth House."
That stopped the tiny bone in Gideon's soul snapping. That stopped her from striding forward and balling both hands in the exquisite linen and chill mail of his robes. That and the fact that she hadn't been straight-up shield-bashed yet by Colm the Eighth, and wasn't in a hurry to experience this exciting time. She stepped forward. Silas did not step away, but he turned his head a little from her, as though she were a bad breath. He had very brown eyes, startlingly framed by thick, whitish lashes. "Don't pretend like you know what happened to me there," she said. "Glorica never remembered I was alive, didn't care about me when she remembered, and she wouldn't have said anything to you on the subject. You don't know anything about me, and you don't know anything about the House of the Ninth."
"You are wrong on both points," said Silas, to somewhere over her shoulder.
"Prove it."
"You are invited to come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht."
She scrubbed both her dirty fists into her eyes and narrowly avoided gumming one up with the terrible orangey salve, which was so noxious that it apparently caused splinters to leap from her body rather than hang around near it. Her corneas misted up momentarily with the smell. "Sorry, didn't hear you right," she said, "because I thought you said, 'Come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht,' the dumbest thing to say ever."
"You are invited to come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht," Silas repeated,
with the kind of hard patience that indicated a mantra going on inside his pallid head.
"You will not bring the daughter of the locked tomb, but you'll bring yourself, and you will be ready to listen. No price, no hidden motive, just an invitation to become more than what you are now."
"Which is," Silas said,
"the tool of your oppressors, the lock on your own collar." She couldn't handle any more, having already lived a long night and suffered a number of emotional torments, among them supernatural murder and petty interpersonal drama.
Gideon shrugged her cloak over her shoulders, thrust her free hand into a pocket, and stalked down the corridor away from any uncles and nephews. The necromancer's voice drifted down after her.
"Will you come and listen to what I have to say? Be decisive."
"Eat me, milkman," said Gideon, and staggered around the corner. She heard Colum's,
"Means yes, probably,"
but not the murmured reply. From that time on, Gideon could not outfight the nightmares. She willed her subconscious to sink into a pattern of random eye movement that did not involve her waking up in a lather of cold sweat, but like so many things in her life now, it had lost fitness and apt response. She was dumb before the body of her failures, unmanned by the barrage of her brain. Gideon only had to close her eyes to see her own personal, randomly selected shit show. Magnus Quinn, still drinking his grassy morning tea, stabbed until his chest was steaming chunks of meat because she could not make her tongue yell, "Look behind you!" A steaming cauldron, filled with fragrant grain and the silent fetal corpse of Abigail Pent, sinking beneath the surface before Gideon's blistering fingers could dig her clear. Isaac Tetteris, gulping and swallowing from an upturned jug of acid that she was unable to wrench from his febrile, trembling hands. Jean-Marie Chateur, whose dismembered arms and legs kept turning up while Gideon made a bed that got stickier and wetter and more jumbled with bits of Jean-Marie as the covers were turned, and the old